This is June 7th, 1985. Sylvie Bucis and Eleanor Mermelstein for National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. The second interview with Saul Weisberg, and we're doing it at the United Jewish Federation building on McKee Place. Saul, we had a wonderful time with you last week, and we wended our way to 1955, to the beginning of the merger of the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies and the United Jewish Fund to form the present United Jewish Federation, and we only got as far as saying that Lewis Kaplan prided himself on being the first elected president. And we'd like you to tell us what was happening during that administration.
Well, perhaps the most important event that occurred at that time outside of the merger was the employment of Bob Hiller as executive. As I said last week, Dr. Taylor had, who was the executive of both the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies and the United Jewish Fund since sometime in the 30s, I think around 1935 or 36, whatever it may have been. In 1955, Dr. Taylor became ill with cancer and was incapacitated for 9 months, finally died. While he was incapacitated, Jim Bronner was an interim acting director, but
had he been on the staff of the two agencies, or?
I'll go back to that.
Okay.
Jim Bronner was acting director for a period, but the executive committee and the board, the merge group actually, selected Bob Hiller from Cleveland to become the new executive. Yes, Jim had been on the staff of both the Federation and the United Jewish Fund since back in the early 1940s. He and Harry Rosen, whom we may have mentioned previously, I don't know, had been the two principal subordinates of Dr. Taylor from the 40s through in the 40s. Harry Rosen left in about 1947 or 48, whatever it was, 48, I think, and Jim became really the number two person, let's put it that way, of the staff, both of the fund and the Federation. He was campaign director and so forth.
How did all of these people manage to staff two agencies with quite different goals?
No problem.
Did they split their time in half?
No. I don't remember any formal arrangement. If there was a budget session with the community chest, you became a representative of the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. If there was a budget session of the United Jewish Fund, you worked for the United Jewish Fund. The only people who had problems were lay people. In the sense that someone like a Donald Steinfurst, whose name I'm sure, hope is familiar to you.
He was the Louise music
Freund's,
critic.
Music critic, but Louise Freund's brother, I guess. Donald, wasn't Donald Louise's brother? I think so.
I don't know.
Sure. Anyway, no, it had to be brother-in-law. Donald was Louise's brother-in-law. Donald was very active in the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, but he was not active, for example, in the United Jewish Fund. Emanuel Spector was active in the United Jewish Fund, but not particularly active in the Federation. It relates to what I said last week about the different interests of what can be characterized as the two groups in the community. the one group is primary, the primary interest of which was Israel, and therefore the United Jewish Appeal, and the fundraising for the United Jewish Appeal, which meant therefore that its primary interest was the United Jewish Fund. And the other group, its primary interest was local agencies, particularly the Mother Pure Hospital, and other local agencies encompassing the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, and which were not particularly, a group of which were not particularly interested in Israel, some of whom could, I think, be characterized even as anti-Zionist. And as I attempted to say last week, the merger finally brought these two groups together, and separatism and the antagonisms finally began to work itself out. But as I started off this morning, the most important step, I think, that the group took was the bringing to Pittsburgh of Bob Hiller. Bob was very young. I don't really think he was yet 35. But he was very strong and really very astute in his approach. And when he was interviewed to come to Pittsburgh, he put down as a condition of employment that he must get the support of what he would, what he called the leaders of the Jewish community before he came, which meant that they would have to accept positions in the merged federation, positions of responsibility, and that they would also have to give them what could be called financial support, although in those days financial support was not as substantial as it is today. And there was a group, those are the ones who hired him, who agreed to that. They included Leon Falk, Louis Kaplan, Louis Reinstein, and I don't remember who else. And it was as a result of that that the condition that Louis Reinstein became the named first president, and more importantly in many ways, that Louis Kaplan became the first elected president. And the assumption and the premise was that these men, who were not old in years really, but nevertheless were recognized as old in leadership, would maintain a stable federation until Bob, who was young, could develop new young federation in leadership. And in many ways, the premise was fulfilled. Louis Kaplan, who was a very strong and, I must say, a very difficult person in many ways, and there are a legion of stories about his personality.
Well, we'd love to have you share some of them with us.
Well, but he was very, very difficult, and some of the lawyers in town who worked with him, and some of the lawyers who were in his office and so forth, remember him very well. One comment I'll make about this was he was a stickler for punctuality. And as a matter of fact, in his private practice, as distinct from Federation, if you didn't show up on time, he wouldn't see you. If you had an appointment with him, it's just, I never, it never happened to me. But my understanding is that if you had an appointment with him at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if you showed up at 3:03, he wouldn't see you. He was very difficult as a person. You know the story of Louis Kaplan. You know, he grew up in an orphanage
well,
and all
I
that.
Think it would be very valuable for you
well,
to share it for us here on the
I'll
tape.
Go very briefly to say that I'm trying to remember what his native town was. Johnstown, I think, where, I don't know whether it was a fire or what happened, but he lost his parents, and he grew up in the Kusky Orphanage, which was in the north side when he was growing up, which was before 1900. He apparently was very bright and certainly a very hard worker, and went eventually into law, where he became a protege of Judge Josiah Cone, who was a very highly regarded individual, both in the Jewish community and in the total community. And eventually Lewis Kaplan, as a, along with a fellow named Charles Sachs, who was also an attorney, eventually Lewis Kaplan and Charles Sachs became the principal attorneys in the Jewish community of Pittsburgh. And Lewis then, as time went on, became a national figure in the organized Jewish community, becoming president of the American Jewish Committee and so forth. And also became, as Lewis Kaplan also became a, I wouldn't use the word dominant, but almost a dominant figure in the local Jewish community. And the force of his personality and more, I'll say it that way. The force of his personality and the force of his intellect made it possible for him to really control most local meetings, certainly, in which he participated. Nationally, I'm not so sure that he was such a dominant figure. I remember having a conversation with someone whose name I won't mention about this, who agreed that locally Lewis Kaplan was very, very strong, but said that when Lewis Kaplan got on the national scene and began to deal with some of the national figures, he was no longer quite as dominant. But he was a very strong figure, but very difficult, accustomed to having his own way, very sarcastic on occasions, and so forth.
Did he ever marry?
He was married once for a very short time. I don't know how short. Never did get the story quite straight. To someone who was either Jane Epstein's aunt, or anyway, very close to Jane. And that is why Lewis Kaplan, as you may or may not know, remained very, very close to the Epstein family for many years. And they looked upon him as a member of the family, really. And Perry Morrison's wife,
B.G.
Who?
They call her B.G.
Yeah, B.G. always looked upon him, I don't know, I wouldn't say a grandfather, but certainly looked upon him as being, what should we say, a great uncle and so forth, and very protective of him. He lived to, not too many years ago. I had a fair amount of dealings with him. They were always successful. He did take the presidency, and the Federation, as a merged organization, went on its way, attempting to increase its fundraising and to begin to project a strong, united image in the community. One of the elements of the program was the development and erection of this particular building. Both Bob and Lewis, although I think it really came from Bob, felt that it would be a very good thing for Federation to have its own building. Prior to this, the Federation owned the 11th floor of the building in 200 Ross Street. We were a co-owner with the Community Chest, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, and the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh.
Is that the current United Way headquarters?
The current United Way headquarters, now known as the John P. Robin Building. I used to know Jack when I was in city planning years ago. But we owned that one floor, which we had bought, I don't know, about 1950 or 1952, when the four agencies, probably at the instigation of the United Way, although in those days it was the Community Chest, of course, decided that it would like to have its own headquarters. And the building was bought from Jones and Laughlin, and it was in good shape, and it was a really a very successful successful venture of joint ownership. I sat in, as a matter of fact, as a member of a joint management committee consisting of professional representatives of each of the four organizations, and we did, I think, a very good job of maintaining the building, setting up a reserve, making some capital repairs, and so forth. Nevertheless, it was not an arrangement which led to promotion of the identity of the Federation. We were there as part of that particular building and so forth. So we did search for, and I use the word we advisedly there, we did search for some other location. There was a lot of discussion about Squirrel Hill, obviously, as opposed to downtown. Discussion about Oakland as opposed to both downtown and Squirrel Hill. And finally, we found this particular, well, since we're putting on tape, finally, we found 234 McKay Place, which had been the home of Senator Jim Coyne, who had been the principal Republican boss of this area for many, many years. And we finally bought the building and tore it down and erected the United Jewish Federation building. And we had a budget, I think, of $280,000, I think, if my memory serves me right, for the construction of the building. This is without the cost of land and so forth. But even that, which sounds like small money today, stretched the resources of the Federation tremendously, so that we had to invade practically completely what was called the special reserve or unrestricted reserve. We had to get a mortgage from, I guess it was Pittsburgh National Bank, and we had to get a mortgage from our own endowment fund. And in order to get a mortgage from our own endowment fund, we had to get a legal opinion from one of our legal laypersons. I think it was Sam Goldstock who did it for us, legal opinion saying that it was appropriate and legal for the Federation to use endowment funds to put up a building. Anyway.
So this building was completed what year?
Well, it was completed, I guess, in 1959. We rushed to completion so that Lewis Kaplan could preside over the dedication. It's true.
Well, he was still president, you mean?
Yeah, he was completing his presidency. The building was not ready for occupancy. The building, it's an interesting story, and I'll talk about it because it's illuminating in some ways about the way people think and relationships and so forth. As I said, we had a limited budget, $280,000. Some of us, I was one of them, was determined to live within that budget. We really had to. We didn't have, unfortunately, the kind of endowment givers that Cleveland had. When Cleveland put up its building, and they did around the same time that we did, each of 10 individuals contributed $100,000 to the building, and they had $1 million with which to put up a building. Even then, they made mistakes. We had a very limited budget. We had a small building committee chaired by Stanley Kant. Bernie Halpern was one of the members. And we interviewed some architects. And the decision of the committee soon focused on whether to attempt to put together a building that was marked by in style and could be what might be called a prestigious promoter of image, or whether to live, so to speak, within the limitations of the budget and have a building that was really practical in the sense that it met what were clearly the needs of the building. And a couple of young architects, Fred Fargenstein, the principal, and Marty Shetland, who's still around, came in, and this was contrary, by the way, to at least the practice. I'm not so sure about the ethics, but at least to the practice of the architects of the days. They came in with a model not too different from this building, and the committee liked the model because it was modern, contemporary, lots of glass, you know, and it had a certain kind of image. There was a lot of concern on the part of some of the members of the committee, and certainly on my part, about whether the building as described was really practical and whether it was going to exceed our budget. And I still remember very vividly asking Fred Fargerstein, you mean that this building with the glass and so forth is not going to cost more than our budget and also is going to be practical, et cetera. And he swore, he was a very young and relatively inexperienced architect, he swore that, yes, it would do that. And the committee finally went that way. I didn't want it. I remember a conversation I had with Stan and Ken, but I, anyway.
So this is Fred Fargerstein's
design? Yes, he's no longer, I'm sure no longer alive. He had a stroke somewhere along the line many years ago, and I don't know what happened to him finally.
I had always heard the name Ben Swanger in relation to this building, huh?
No, Ed, Ben Swanger was an architect, made a proposal. It was a very good proposal, in my opinion, but it was expensive. No.
Oh, this
the architects for the building were Fred Fargerstein and Marty Chetlin. And as a result of the requirements, which I won't go into too much detail, of the that were imposed by the glass and anyway, by the fact that we couldn't live within the budget, there were a lot of changes made which impaired the practical operation of the building. We had problems for years, as you know, with air conditioning and...
You really still do.
No, I'm assuming it's a lot better, but from your standpoint, as you think back over the building and so forth, I think you understand what I'm saying. A lot of that has been corrected, but we had all of those problems stemmed from the original decision to accept the premise that the building should be, I don't want to use the word monument because that's not quite right, but should be a certain kind of image maker, even though we didn't have the money to support that premise. And it taught me, although I think I knew it already, but it taught me a lesson, which is how often the consequences of your action and so forth are dictated by the premise that you accept at the very beginning. And in planning, I've always tried very hard. I don't mean to lecture. But,
well, it's important for us to hear your philosophy, Saul.
But... it's worthwhile saying is that is that in planning I always tried very hard to remember to understand what the original premise was and to try to foresee what the consequences would be of accepting a particular premise. This building was a very much a an example of that. It wasn't just air conditioning, there were other problems too. Interestingly enough, we had a tremendous struggle around the question of whether to have a basement or whether to have a preparations to enable the third floor to be added. And it was really a very strong argument. The principal proponent of the third floor concept was Sam Hordick. You remember that name?
Yes, of course.
The principal proponent, as much as I guess I can say it that way, of having a basement was Saul Weisberg, because I was going to be the one, you know, operating, so to speak, the building and so forth. And as I, in a sense, lost the argument with Stanley Kahn, I lost the argument with Sam Hordick. Sam Hordick, at a board meeting where the issue came up, stood up and made a very, very strong statement in favor of having a third floor, and don't really need a basement, but you can never predict the future and so forth, which was true, except that we needed the basement as well, and we couldn't afford both. I guess I didn't preface it by saying we couldn't afford both the basement and preparation third floor. We had to choose between the two. And particularly because of the urgings of Sam Horlick, the building to this day is prepared to have a third floor. Over in what was the campaign division, there is an elevator shaft, and an elevator can be put into this building so that it is feasible, and the structural supports are there.
And
so
we don't have a basement?
We have only a half basement, a quarter of a basement, which has been a big problem in terms of the storage, particularly of archives, so that many archives, or archival material rather, has been lost, which I think is a very unfortunate thing. I used to hang on to stuff, but eventually when I no longer was, intimately involved in that, people began to throw things away. And today all sorts of stuff, which I think is unfortunate, has disappeared, I'm sure. But that was the building. In the meantime, another very important step was taken within the Federation. That was really the development of a functioning and, on the whole, strong social planning and budgeting committee. Prior to the merger, the Federation did have a planning committee and I guess you'd call it a budget committee, last chairman of which really was Bob Cummins, and the United Jewish Fund obviously had a budget committee. The name of its chairman, the last chairman, escaping me at the moment.
So, did you ever share with us what were the factors that promoted this merger or made people realize that this was a wise step?
I don't know that I have talked about it, but I think the factors, as I think I mentioned it, but we can talk about it. First of all, and you can never underestimate, I think, the importance of this, it was a national trend. It was a national trend. And the reason it was a national trend was that having the two organizations meant basically that you had a split community, with one community focusing primarily on local affairs and another community, that was another element in your Jewish community, focusing primarily on international affairs. Now this was acceptable, let's say in the 30s and to some extent in the early 40s, when the importance of Israel or Palestine was not so preeminent. But it became no longer acceptable to have this divided community when it became no longer reasonable to have this divided community when it became
2 minutes. Okay, keep going.
When it became clear that Palestine, or beginning in 1948, Israel, had become really the overriding preoccupation of the Jewish people. And as important as the monocure appeared to be to some people, such as an I.D. Wolf and a Stanley Kahn and so forth, even they, certainly I think Stanley in the final analysis, began to recognize that Israel was the key issue. Not necessarily because of the establishment of the state, but because of the, I'll use the grand term, of the ingathering of the exiles. I mean, the rescue of the refugees, after all, was of keen importance to everybody. And whatever the attitude might have been towards the establishment of the state, where there was this great split in within the Zionist movement itself up until up until the middle of the war, everybody recognized the urgency of rescuing the refugees. And so that in some ways, the same factors that brought around the merger into the First Federation, where it just wasn't efficient, effective, philosophically acceptable, and so forth, to have a variety of interests and groups and people attempting to accomplish the same purpose. When the 40s arrived and the 50s arrived, it became impractical to everyone to continue to have separate and split interests, which impaired the effectiveness of the efforts to rescue people.